the galaxy. This is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
So there is one question that the Free Zone has been chasing, and that is the nature of the occult. It seems it's not enough to simply ask the question, what is magic? As the answer lies deep within occulted history, occulted bloodlines, and even warring secret societies. So to dig into this mystery deeper, there's no one better equipped to look at all these aspects than Tracy Twyman. She is the author of The Merovingian Mythos, Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge, and her latest release, Clock Shavings, which is going to blow your mind for sure. So welcome to the show, Tracy.
Thank you so much. I've heard a lot about the show before. I've seen some of your previous programs, and I'm really excited to be on. Thanks.
Well, fantastic. Yeah, this is a place where we can dig deeper into the occult. You have a knowledgeable audience listening to you. They already know what a Baphomet is, although I know you can get deeper into even what that is. And so you can feel free to openly discuss the heavier topics here and know that okay. The audience is actually receiving you. I mean, I really want to know you, Tracy. This is a point of my show. I know we have a lot of topics that we can cover, but I want to get into the nature of Tracy Twyman, the ideas, because you came up through the study of the, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, getting into the Merovingian bloodlines. You have your book, The Merovingian Mythos. But now we find you in the dark corners opening up Ouija boards and opening communications to the other side. And this is what truly intrigues me. I want to know about magic. I want to understand. And I want to understand how you got from studying these levels of history, the occulted history, to popping open the Ouija board and hanging out with Nicholas Devere.
Well, my relationship with Devere probably started a couple years before that, before the Ouija board. But I had been doing Dagobert's Revenge, which was a magazine that was all about that topic of the Merovingians and the Holy Grail and the Priory of Zion. And also I was working with one of the writers we had at the magazine. We were doing going to do a book about that topic also. So I was in Denver working on that. I had been talking to Nicholas Devere, the leader of the Dragon Court, another one of these bloodline secret societies associated with bloodlines. I had been talking to him for a while, and he had a book that he had written that had been, he said, basically plagiarized by another writer. And that guy had actually made lots of money with Nicholas's book.
It
seemed. And, yeah.
I've read Lawrence Gardner.
There was some interesting stuff there. I mean, it really seemed to be going along the same lines as the research I was doing, which was, pointing towards the origin of these royal bloodlines having maybe a little bit to do with Jesus and Mary Magdalene. That could be part of it. But it seemed like really the mythology that really surrounded all these bloodlines went back much further, to the Garden of Eden, to the fallen angels and the Nephilim breeding with humans. And so I was interested in that idea. It seemed like, the origin of these bloodlines, what makes them special, apparently, perhaps is a connection to, Satan, essentially. And then this is what Nicholas Devere was saying. And he said his bloodline came from that, that all of the royal bloodlines of the earth basically originated with the connection between fallen angels or Satan and humans actually breeding with each other.
And so, this coming out in the line of Cain.
Yes, yes. And that was one of the things I had just been writing about and developing in the magazine. It was going to be a big topic in the book, was that basically that the myths seem to point to sort of a hidden tradition. And in Kabbalism, it's less hidden. It's actually explicit that Kabbalists talk about the serpent. And the serpent was a hermaphroditic being, both male and female, that it had a male side called Samael and a female side called Lilith. And both sides bred with Adam and Eve to create hybrid bloodlines. So there's demon, half human, half demon children called Lilim that come from Lilith. And then Cain, according to this thesis, was the child of Samael and Eve. And also the interesting thing about Cain, too, is he matches up with some historical figures, seems to have been an ancient king in pre-Diluvian times, one of the earliest kings, actually, and had a big empire. So this is the kind of stuff we were developing, me and some of the other writers, and my husband also at the time, Brian Albert. Well, he didn't become my husband until maybe a year or so after we started doing the Ouija board. But we were living together. He was helping me with the magazine. He was one of the people running the thing. And he helped me a lot with research and stuff. I talked to him about what I was working on all the time. And he was a very smart guy. He knew a lot of stuff. So we worked with each other on it. And, you know, I was trying to figure out stuff about my research. I was really knee deep into really specific esoteric stuff from, yes, the Priory of Zion's own literature and the symbolism in some of the things they had said about themselves, and then connecting that to Rosicrucian's symbols and information and lots of Masonic stuff and stuff related to the Templars. I'm being kind of vague here, but at any rate, you know, we were doing all this research. I was finding all these interesting connections. I wanted to find a little bit more. I was getting almost lost in the overwhelming amount of information and the kind of dizzying, all the connections between things, you know. It was just so much, and I needed, like, some clue for how to approach it. And the idea came up one night. I had just moved in with the guy who became my husband, Brian, and we'd moved to Denver. And so one night we were just talking about how Jean Cocteau, who's one of the guys supposedly grandmaster of the Priory of Zion, he was a French artist and also a poet and did some films, like avant-garde films. And I had been researching his stuff and finding what seemed like lots of clues that could be interpreted as meaningful. If you believed the idea that he was connected to the Priory of Zion, then you could look at his artwork and find maybe illumination about the mysteries of the Priory of Zion and the Holy Grail and things like that. So anyway, we decided to contact him on the Ouija board because Jean Cocteau, as it turns out, in his own life had been very involved in doing seances with a group of other people. One of them actually in the group was Victor Hugo and his wife. So it was like Jean Cocteau and a bunch of these other like poets and playwrights and artists getting together to do seances, and which they called it table rapping at the time. It worked a little bit differently than Ouija boards. But anyway, they used to do that stuff. And I thought, well, let's try it. Let's see if Jean Cocteau, now that he's dead, see if he'll talk to us the way the ghosts talked to him when he was alive. So we tried it, and it actually worked.
Amazing. That sounds like a heck of a party, too.
Well, you know, and it was really spontaneous at the time, the first time it happened, because I think actually he was moving his stuff, unpacking his things, and he had a Ouija board in one of the boxes, so he brought it out, and he didn't have the planchette, the indicator that comes with it, though, so we had to use a bottle of spice, cumin, actually. We emptied it out, and we used the bottle, and like I say in the book, which is my book, Clock Shavings, is all about the Ouija board seances that happened for years. It's really still happening. It happened a couple of weeks ago, even. We're still doing it. Me and my current husband now are doing it. But the majority of it happened a few years ago. And so this book is all about the seances, the things that were said. I actually have extensive transcripts of a lot of the sessions, the whole story of what was going on around this time, you know, what was happening, because what ended up happening was Brian, me, some other friends, we had this group that we called it Ordo Lapsus Exilis. And at the time it was really just something, you know, I wanted to have my own secret society to go with the magazine, basically. And we would put in the magazine right at the beginning that it's published by Ordo Lapsus et Excellus. And what that is it just comes from the term for the Holy Grail that was used in the Wolfram von Eschenbach version of the Grail story. It was published in the 1800s. That was the German version. And he called it the stone that fell from heaven, and that was the Latin phrase that he used to refer to it. But it's kind of not proper Latin. It's actually he's the one who messed it up. It's not exactly perfect, but at any rate, he coined this phrase, and so I thought I would just copy it exactly as it is, bad Latin and all. And we use that for the name of our organization. Originally, the whole idea behind it was just, you know, promoting the mythos of the Grail and research into the Grail. And we would just put, you know, the logo, which was the Cross of Lorraine at the time, in the magazine. I and some of my other friends had pendants that we would wear with the Cross of Lorraine on them. We would tell people we were members of this organization if they asked. But we didn't do much beyond that. But the order and the Ouija board seances ended up merging and becoming involved in each other. And so the Ordo Lapsus et Excellus, I would say, ended up becoming, to a certain extent, a real magical order. It had, we opened it up to broader membership. We had 3 degrees. The other people mainly were like the Rosicrucians do it. You know, we were doing basically mail order initiations for some of the lower degree people. They would take blood oaths on paper. Actually, they would cut themselves in an oath ceremony that we would tell them to do, and bleed onto the paper and send it back to us. And we would have it on our file. All the people who were second degree members had taken the blood oath. The third degree members didn't have to take any oaths. They just had to join the website. So we ended up running this order, and it was all associated with the beings that we ended up talking to on the Ouija board, which included Cain and Baphomet. Jean Cocteau only talked to us for a little while, and he wasn't really able to answer our questions very clearly, so he told us to talk to Cain. And after talking to Cain for a while and getting lots of really great information from him, then we got referred to Baphomet, and that's where I would say we got most of the information after that.
Crazy.
So that's what's in the book. Yep. And you were talking about how it seems like a departure or a strange turn for me to take writing about this stuff, but I mean, really, this has been part of my research process this entire time, as a way of getting ideas or inspiration about what angle to take when I'm trying to figure something out, when I'm researching something. And of course, I never just, you know, quote something that a demon said on a Ouija board and put it in a book. But, you know, it's a springboard for the research that I do sometimes. Yeah, because, yeah. You know, again, they don't always tell me the truth or they don't, and they're not always giving me useful information, but sometimes they really do. I mean, and a lot of things, really specific stuff that I wouldn't have known myself at all and wouldn't have ever been able to figure out on my own, you know. And a lot of it has turned out to be true. So it has actually been a very valuable resource to me.
Well, you have a lot of background in the ancient history of all of this, which absolutely helps. I mean, working with Nicholas Devere, the whole idea of the line of Cain and the curses that go along with this that have really continued to manifest throughout time. This is the type of information that you were able to draw out of the Ouija board because you knew the right questions to ask, right?
I think so. I mean, I think I had already been tapped into some sort of higher, I don't know if you want to call it a higher power, but it's something from beyond, definitely. Like when I first started researching this stuff, I was 17 and I was about to turn 18, and I was taking a calculus class, actually. I was about to take the final exam. I actually mentioned this in the book, how the whole thing started. I was trying to take this calculus exam. I was studying for it at night, but I had just read Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the popular book about this subject that came out in the 80s. And this was 1996, I guess, when this event happened.
It was an amazing year, really.
And so I was just sitting there trying to study, but I couldn't concentrate because I had this idea that was just started forming in my head about creating a magazine that would be all about that subject. Specifically, I thought, because in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, it talks about the Priory of Zion, how they put out these strange magazines, and they deposited them in the library in France, and then the people that wrote Holy Blood, Holy Grail ended up finding those magazines, and that's how they found out about the Priory of Zion even existing, and that's where they got all their information initially about what that organization was, and all that stuff about the supposed Merovingian bloodline. It all came from that magazine that the Priory of Zion published. And so I thought, well, that's a cool idea. Why don't I put out something like that? And people will think that I have a secret society, and, you know, we'll just see what happens. And
well, so, whose famous name did you put in your list of grandmasters? The Zion had what, Leonardo da Vinci?
I actually wanted people to think that it was the Priory of Zion putting it out, or that's what I was hinting at, I guess.
Gotcha.
So I was just hijacking what they were doing initially. And so anyway, that's how the whole thing started. And from that moment, I really feel like I kind of got tapped into something. I don't know if I asked for it or if it asked me to do it, but I joined this mission somehow that ended up taking over my life, really. You know, I just put out one magazine initially, and I forgot about it for years, and I brought it back in 1999. And then, even though I was taking film classes at the time and had a totally different plan for my life, I just ended up continuing the magazine, continuing this research, and it was because it just kept giving to me. You know, I kept pulling the thread, and it kept unraveling. I just kept following the clues, and I would find out more and more stuff. And a lot of it was stuff that, I mean, I would figure out things that, as far as I could tell, weren't in the books. Connections between the books that the people that wrote the books hadn't figured out yet. So I just had to keep going, and that's what I've been doing since. Gosh, it's been like 20 years. I don't know. It's been a long time. And I just keep coming up with this stuff, but I really feel like I've been driven this entire time. And I don't know if it's entirely by demons or if there's some hopefully higher power at work, but at any rate, I definitely have been getting messages from beyond about how to conduct my research for this entire time. And so yeah, when I finally actually started talking to them on the Ouija board and they were talking back, I was getting a clear conversation going, then yeah, well, it was like I very easily established a rapport with them because I was so deeply involved in the types of ideas that you know, are what they are all about. It's at least the ones I was talking to, Cain and Baphomet. I mean, the mysteries surrounding them it was something I really knew a lot about, and so I knew exactly the right questions to ask. And yeah, I just have gotten some amazing results over the years. And I was just dying to tell people, you know, because I can only tell part of the story, really, or part of the information if I don't reveal the where the information came from. So I wanted to be able to reveal some of the things that I wouldn't write in a normal nonfiction book. You know, I just wanted to be able to tell the story of how all this stuff happened. And that's what's in the book. I finally got the proof from the printer yesterday. I keep looking at the book, and you know, I'm really impressed. I'm really impressed with this thing that I created.
Nice.
Definitely the best book I've ever written, I think.
The title, Clock Shavings. Can you explain that?
Yeah, sure. Well, there's a quote at the beginning of the book, and I'll just read it to you. It's from God of the Witches by Dr. Margaret Alice Murray, who was an anthropologist in the early 20th century. So she had a book about all the witchcraft craze in Europe, you know, medieval to Renaissance Europe. And so she wrote, "The Swedish witches had a special rite which was obviously intended to impress ignorant minds. They were given a little bag containing a few shavings of a clock to which a stone was tied. They threw this into the water, saying, 'As these shavings of the clock do never return to the clock from which they are taken, so may my soul never return to heaven.' And there's a band. What is it? There's a band that has some kind of song about a black mass. It's one of those metal bands from the 70s. Anyway, that I think that's the only other reference to this quote from Margaret Alice Murray about the shavings of a clock. When you look up shavings of a clock on Google, this is all you find almost, because I had never heard the term clock shavings before, and I'm wondering, are we talking about like metal filings from the gears of a clock?
Right.
And I had to dig and dig, and I guess that's what they're talking about. But so it's a very specific thing. You don't find this term very often. And yeah, like I said, the only other reference I could find was from this metal band.
I think the group is Black Sabbath. And
No, it's not.
Oh, okay. I was thinking of witches in their black masses. Because that all ties back to the OTO, goes back to Baphomet, and starts to get into people you're chatting with.
Yes. So. Well, I mean, basically, you know, when over the years of trying to figure out what all these messages meant, what the whole thing that happened, I had to wait years to figure out what it really meant between me and Baphomet. I mean, it started off, you know, we were just getting information. Then he, specifically Baphomet really wanted to have a role in directing the Ordo Lapse at Exilus and what we were doing. And I ended up just doing all these projects kind of at the behest of Baphomet kind of. And I ended up just feeling kind of worn out and used by it. You know, I wasn't getting the results I wanted. And so I ended up closing the whole thing down. Mainly because I started just distrusting what was going on. I felt like I was a slave to this being, you know, and being pushed way too hard, and I didn't know why I was even doing it. I was getting all these other people involved, and I didn't know what I was getting them involved in. And then at the end, I went into this trance one night, and I wrote a book that was supposed to be a manual for the second degree members of the order. And this is the closest I've ever come to automatic writing. I wrote the whole thing in one night, and it really gave me chills when I looked at it later. It's a really scary document in a way. And I didn't actually finish it entirely. I shared the unfinished document with some of the people I was closest to in the order. But then, like a day or so later, I totally regretted sending that to them. And I asked them, please delete that document. Don't ever look at it again. You know, and I said, I'm shutting down the order. I'm sorry. And as soon as I did that, there were these two people who wrote to me almost at the same time. But they were two people that didn't know each other. They weren't friends. And they wrote to me with almost identical requests to take over the order. They said, please don't shut it down. Or if you're going to, then let me run it instead. But they both used very queer language, and I could tell, and almost identical. I could tell they were both being possessed, basically, and forced to do this. You know, that the demon did not want to shut the order down, and was possessing them and trying to get them to stop me. Basically, what I'm saying is, like, I had created something that could very much have done something very dangerous with, and I only realized that just as I was about to do something very dangerous with it. So I shut it down right at the right time to stop that. And then I've just been sitting on all this information since then, developing some of it, but I didn't know what to do with it, and ended up writing this book. I'm sorry, go ahead. I interrupted you. What were you going
to
say?
Oh, no, it's just, it's so similar to what happened to Aleister Crowley with his wife, channeling the Book of the Law, and then opening this Aeon of Horus, and now this is the ultimate influence on our pop culture. When you're talking about Baphomet attempting to possess, or even, you know, take over this whole situation, we see all these references coming through our pop stars such as Beyonce and Lady Gaga and everybody putting up Baphomet and the OTO.
You know, I almost wonder if I and some of the other people who were publishing stuff at the same time had something to do with that, because I do not believe that Beyonce and all these other people are members of any At most, maybe they're members of the OTO, and right. the OTO will take anybody.
I don't see high level meetings with Beyonce being told what to sing about, or you know, definitely not that level. But this level of like you're saying of just kind of influencing the situation, as Baphomet told you in his Ouija readings, that he would influence these situations by being different characters, or right.
I guess what I was saying was I wonder if you know. When I published, what was it, Solomon's Treasure, 2005, I published this book about alchemy and money. And that was at the time the only thing I could think of to do with just a part of the information I had gotten from Baphomet. You know, that was some of the stuff I was able to corroborate and write a nonfiction book about. Because he had told us a lot of stuff about money and alchemy. And so... And also, you know, about how it somehow connects to him, you know, that Baphomet it kind of is the embodiment of that alchemical transformative power of, you know, of the universal agent that can transform base metal into gold. And that is the role that money plays in society, you know. And so Baphomet, in a way, is that power. And you can say that the alchemical nature of the modern economy, the way it's structured, really, I think, was inspired by Baphomet. And, you know, that goes all the way back to the fact that the Templars invented the credit system. And the Templars, of course, they said in their confessions after they got disbanded by the church and the French monarchy that they got rich because of Baphomet. That's why they worshipped him, because he made them rich. His wisdom made them rich. And I think it was basically he told them how to set up a credit system.
And, of course, the Baphomet of the Templars was more talking head than the goat-headed beast of Eliphas Levi.
Exactly. But there was goats were used in the rituals. And
yeah, I've seen the riding goats of the Masons. Have you seen? They got a little wheel. Sorry, it's a chuckle at that, but just this idea of them wheeling themselves around on a goat. But this still comes straight today. You know, we're talking about this ancient ritual, and here it is still being enacted. Absolutely, the goat is part of this ritual. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, and actually, I think connecting the goat head to Baphomet probably goes back to the beginning too. There was this book called The Mysteries of Baphomet Revealed, but in Latin. It was a book that was written in like several different languages. I mean, the book itself had like five different languages in it, and the title was in Latin. It was written by this guy named Joseph von Hammer Purgstall, an Orientalist Viennese guy from the 1800s. And this is really the source for where Eliphas Levi got a lot of his ideas and where a lot of the lore about Baphomet comes from. A lot of people think that his book is not reliable. I'm not so sure it's as reliable as anything. There's not a lot of information about this subject, so you kind of have to go to Purgstall for some of the information. And what he had in his book, amongst other things, was some of the images that he said actually came from Templar properties that seemed to have cultic and Gnostic connections, you know, and actually he reproduced some of these things in the book that are obviously Gnostic. And one of them was this being with a goat head. And another is someone definitely a kind of hermaphroditic being standing in a position kind of similar to Baphomet. So I think that all the imagery that Eliphas Levi used, you know, he thought it was based on something the Templars were doing, and it may very well have been. And he also considered that there's an esoteric stream happening of information where people who are initiated into the secrets of Baphomet, they're going to maybe be told exactly what the images are they should be using in their rituals and what type of rituals to do, as we were. I mean, I was told specific rituals to do, and we did them. I was told a specific design for the Ouija board to do. And the design actually incorporated this thing called the Atbash cipher, which involves inverting the alphabet. So that's how we displayed the alphabet on the Ouija board that Baphomet told us to design. And it turned out, I didn't realize this at the time, but as it turned out, I mean, we didn't realize when we were rearranging the alphabet that it was the Atbash cipher, and the Atbash cipher is something that's been associated with the Templars for a long time. This is how you can encode the word Sophia or wisdom to come out to be Baphomet. So I'm just saying, like, my point is just that Eliphas Levi and the Rosicrucians, Crowley and the OTO people, they all could very well be continuing the real tradition of the Templars and Baphomet, even if there's no real historical connection between them and the Templars, because all you have to do is talk to Baphomet and he will tell you what to do. And he can pass that, what do you call it? The magical current.
Right.
That's how you get a legitimate connection to an order from the past, is a magical current. It's not necessarily that you have to get a piece of paper signed by the last Grand Master of that order. It's that you have to get a legitimate contract, basically, with the outer head or the demon that's really the head of that order. If you can connect with the same demon that was running some order from the past, then you can reignite it. You have the right then to do that if you talk to, you know, the demon yourself personally.
Well, that answers one of... Sorry?
I said, I think that's what's going on sometimes.
Well, that answers one of the bigger questions of the New World Order as we watch these old men that are obviously going to die off, and many have already died off in the creation of a New World Order. Why the plan would continue on in a straight line when the heads keep falling off, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that explains a lot of things, actually, and it's really the only place to look if you want to avoid driving yourself crazy, actually. I think it's more crazy to look for a human conspiracy to explain all of the coincidences that occur. When you look at history, you look at current events, you notice symbolism, you notice of the same things happening over and over again, and you think, oh, well, it must be that they're all in on it together. But then you think about it more, and that doesn't really make sense, does it? Well, it doesn't, and they're not in on it together. It's just that they're all being inspired by the same thing.
Well, currently, ISIS is on the lips of everyone, and I understand ISIS to be an archetypal magical force, if not the very goddess of magic, and relates. What do you have to say on the ISIS side of this situation?
Well, God, I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's interesting that they're called that.
It was just that you were talking about currents of magic, and I thought perhaps that this was a current they were trying to really activate at this moment.
They may be. It's just, it's a little bit vague as to why, right? I mean, why are they connecting it to ISIS specifically? I don't know, but it's something dark, definitely. I mean,
yeah.
It's not...
Well, it keeps relating back to this Gates of Hell, and we've got Ciri, which, as Clyde Lewis was saying, was obviously Sirius, which actually is Sothis, which is Isis. And Ciri saying about the Gates of Hades opening, and then we have them saying, we're going to chase Isis to the Gates of Hell. This is getting pretty strange.
Well, this is exactly, I didn't want to go too far afield here mentioning this, but this is something that I had mentioned on my website, is that, yeah, the imagery associated with what's going on in Iraq right now, I think, really does bring that up. This is what people think of when they see it. You know, they think of the Gates of Hell opening, literally. And also the other prep work that's been laid for the last few years of the zombie apocalypse and stuff like that, in a way, people are expecting this kind of stuff. And then and that's kind of what it is, because this army, the ISIS people, they're really crazy. And, I don't know if younger members of the audience especially really realize this, but this is way more hardcore even than the terrorists of the past, even the terrorists that did 9/11. This is kind of really extreme stuff. And you can tell that these people have, well, we know, the leaders of ISIS are all people that have been released from Gitmo after years of torture and who knows what kind of brainwashing and hypnotism and of course, you know, so who knows what's been done to their brains while they were at Gitmo. And before that, you know, they were members of Al-Qaeda, and also before they went rampaging through Iraq, they were in Syria. Both Al-Qaeda and then the Syrian rebels and the ISIS people that were part of the rebellion in Syria, those were all people being trained by U.S. intelligence and military and military contractors that, as we know, you know, are knee-deep in all of this really sinister torture, mind control stuff. And, you know, so lo and behold, these people have been through these extreme, you know, torture, mind control training sessions first when they were terrorists working at the behest of CIA. Then they went through this torture and mind control at Gitmo after they got caught, and then they got released. I guess what I'm saying is, like, who knows? It's almost for sure, actually, that they have been programmed to do what they're doing by intelligence, basically, you know, American intelligence. And the other thing is that, well, they might be on drugs or something. I mean, the way they're acting, I wonder if they're on something. But yeah, I think basically this is a, you could think of it as a mind controlled demonic horde of zombies that has been released all over the Middle East, rampaging, cutting off heads, and you know, threatening the West to do the same over here. And yeah, okay, so back to Baphomet. It does connect.
Okay.
Well, not, and Cain. Okay.
That's what I was
thinking. We talked to Cain not too long ago about this subject. Actually, around the end of July, because these topics about the gates of hell, you know, the fact that the subject kept coming up in headlines around that time made me think, well, I wonder if there's something to this, you know. And actually, quite a lot of the messages we've received from Cain and Baphomet were about hell. I mean, that's where they are, and they've said as much. So, and they've talked about the apocalypse and end times and how they're going to be released on Earth, basically. And they think they're going to create some kind of empire on Earth. And then also, eventually, they think they're going to defeat God somehow. They really think they're going to win somehow. But at any rate, so yeah, we asked Cain literally 3 weeks ago. We said, is there anything to this about the gates of hell opening? And he said, yes, that has happened. And I said, when? And he said, 16 days ago. So the date doesn't exactly coincide with what Siri said about when the gates of Hades would open, but it's off by literally just a few days. So, you know, Cain, for what it's worth, is saying that actually the gates of hell have opened, and some of the demons, not all of them, but some of them have been released and come out, and there's more to come. And that's part of what's going on here, actually, that current events are a result of that. So if you can see, how more and more insane this whole thing is becoming every day. I mean, you've got, hordes of diseased people rushing the border down south, and you've got apparently 3,000 troops being sent to Africa to, I don't know, shoot sick people that are trying to escape hospitals. I don't know what exactly they're going to do over there. And then you've got this stuff going on in Iraq and Syria. It does seem like you could equate it with the gates of hell opening, I think.
I think you really could. And they're constantly throwing out these type of references. I think it's so that the Brotherhood themselves can actually catch on that this is part of, say, maybe Baphomet or Satan's plan. But like the Sirius Star was another one, this you know, boat that drew in the piracy of the Sirius Star, drew in every nation into the Gulf of Persia. We have some strange magnetic anomaly opening there. At that point, there was an Ethiopian cardinal that was announcing that he was going to show the world the Ark of the Covenant after he talked to the Pope about it, of course. And then then the Pope exonerated the Knights Templar right at that point.
Yeah.
And we have all this crazy stuff going on underwater and in that Gulf of Persia area. And this, I guess, was still some of the extended area of Cain's kingdom, right? And does all of this play into what's happening now?
It could. You know, I mean, I don't know exactly what's going to happen here. I know, okay, here's what Cain told us about his kingdom, was that Eden apparently was a larger landmass in the beginning. And then there was basically a part of it that the actual tree of life was. And also this thing called the Ark that was like the central, the container of all the treasures of the kingdom. And really the treasure that it contained was this sort of what I've described, the alchemical power, the power of God, really, the power to transform things, creative power. So there was this awesome treasure, basically, in the center of Eden that was, you know, whoever had control of that was the king, you know, had control over everything. It gave power over everything. It gave the godlike power, if you had that, the Ark. And it was in the center of Eden, and as was this, what's being described as tree of life, the fruit of life. And so what he said happened was basically that there was this kingdom at one point. And then he kind of described it as being, he said it was the same as Atlantis. And he said it was kind of like an empire, really, that there was this one main kingdom and there was a bunch of, member states, basically. And at one point there was a rebellion from some of the member states that they wanted to break away. And then they actually tried to usurp the throne of Eden and take all of these treasures. And that that he was the king at the time, or he would have been the rightful king. And these other people, the people running the subject nations, were actually his children, descendants of his. So it was sort of a inter-family battle happening, and that literally a war broke out. And he became so angry when he was fighting this war against his own children who were rebelling to try to take the throne of Eden. He became so angry that he did something, some sort of alchemical, magical ritual, basically. He called it the Wrath of Cain. And whatever it was, I don't know exactly, but it caused the majority of the landmass of what had been Eden or Atlantis to sink beneath the waves. And he died during this. A whole, you know, majority of the rest of the population died. He said that this is what was remembered as the fall of Atlantis and also the flood and the fall of Eden. Like, all of these events were the same thing, really, he said. And that he actually said the game of chess is based on this event. And he said there was originally this game called Ageo that has been forgotten now, but this was the original game that chess was based on. He told us all about how to play this game, actually. You know, we have a lot of the information for how to recreate the game. And actually, a lot of his information panned out as to the actual history of chess, what's known about chess and how it came about. It's not entirely known. Historians don't entirely know how it came about, but there are some traces of information about sort of the prototypes of what chess was, and that information that he gave us turned out to match up exactly with what historians do know about it. So it was pretty interesting. And he said that Ageo actually has a magical ability of its own. It's like a little ritual you do, basically, with the pieces being like little voodoo dolls. And when you move them about and you play the game exactly in the right way, that it has this magical power that you can actually affect reality by playing this game. So that was all kind of interesting. I wish I could use that power somehow to do something, make something happen, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, So I thought I'd mention that because you were talking about all of these locations, interesting locations, on the planet where all these things are happening right now. And a lot of these, these places are basically right around where Eden used to be. And, you know, Eden also supposedly is underneath the waves of the Persian Gulf in some of these areas. So, I don't know. Cain said that he's still definitely very interested in following the actions of his own children, his descendants, the ones that are alive still. And so it seems like the demons, they take some sort of interest in human activities and trying to coordinate them. And I think in general, they're trying to get people doing what I was doing, people who are actually communicating with them, to do their bidding, basically, to make certain events happen on Earth that will, for in whatever way, some, I think, magical way, affect reality, to actually open up this gate to let them out of Hades, and then, which may have already happened, apparently.
Right.
Seems like it may have already happened. So, yeah, that's what I think is going on. And at this point, actually, I'm kind of – part of the reason why I wanted to write this book and get it out there is because I really want to do more of this, actually. And I want to close the gap between me and the public here. I want to be able to put this information out as soon as I get it to tell people what, you know, Cain and Baphomet are telling us these days. Because it seems like they could shed a lot of light on current events and also on some of the topics that I'm studying right now. So I'm kind of looking to do this more regularly, and I think I might start putting videos on the YouTube channel that I've got where, you know, I'll tell people right away about seances we've had that had interesting results. And hopefully if I can get a decent camera here, I've got some cameras, but they're not very good. So when I can get the proper equipment, I would like to just be able to videotape the sessions and basically have a YouTube show telling people what we're getting from the demons these days.
Right. That would be fantastic. And, you know, the way it's set up now, we could all go live, and you could even, if you wanted to, have a, you know, a massive live broadcast of your reading.
Yeah, why not? You know, okay, so you mentioned the stuff, the weird stuff about the Book of the Law. You know, I hate Aleister Crowley, and I hate Anton LaVey, although I have to reluctantly admit that I ended up, you know, I have in throughout my life ended up using some of their stuff, and they're both mentioned in this book. I hate both those guys so much. But, you know, so there were a lot of weird coincidences with this book, okay, Clock Shavings. I published it. I submitted it to the printer on my birthday, and that was an accident. It was meant to be submitted a couple weeks earlier, but you know, various things ended up delaying it. And so when I finally submitted it, like a few minutes after submitting it, I realized, oh my goodness, it's my birthday. And it's not only my birthday, but it's also Johann von Goethe's birthday, who's the guy who wrote Faust. So if that means anything to you. But then there's the numerological things, okay? Like, there ended up being 418 pages. Now, I didn't plan that. That's just what happened. And I'm talking all the way down to the line. Like, the last line, if I had spaced one more line, it would have gone over to the next page. So there's 418 pages in this, which just so happens to be a number that at least Aleister Crowley said is associated with Baphomet and with the magical power of Baphomet, specifically with the word abracadabra, the magic word, that it comes out Kabbalistically to equal 418. In addition to that, I realized yesterday this book is 8 inches by 5 inches, and of course 8 plus 5 is 13, which is a number very much connected to Baphomet. There's 13 chapters that I planned, of course. And then there's, the width of the spine even is 0.93 inches. And of course, the number 93 is something that Aleister Crowley people care about. He said it had something to do with the current aeon. It's
the number of Thelema.
Yeah, okay, well. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I'm so over Aleister Crowley. I really, you know, I'm sick of him and people that quote him. But I couldn't ignore when these numbers popped up. They definitely are connected somehow. You know, and of course, OTO is a Baphometic order. And Aleister Crowley even called himself Baphomet as like his title as the leader of the OTO.
Right.
And There was also, when we were running Ordo Lapsus Exilis, there seemed to be almost a, I, maybe not an infiltration. But that's kind of what I was afraid it was. There was a lot of OTO people that were involved. And I kind of got the feeling that, you know, they wanted to take it over or maybe just find out what we knew, you know, that we had a connection to the same being that they were connected to, and they could feel that, and they wanted to know what exactly we knew. So I've always kind of felt like OTO's breathing down my neck here. And so it was interesting when those numbers popped up in the book. I know that this maybe sounds kooky, but I almost don't believe anything is a coincidence anymore, you know?
I hear you. The idea of channeling a disembodied entity may seem very foreign to us, but it seems that within the elite, this is a common practice. Is this what's going on behind locked doors as secret societies gather and perform strange rituals? Are they receiving communication or even influence from entities such as Baphomet or even Cain? Well, we're going to keep digging deeper here on the Free Zone, so I hope you'll join us in the members section as Tracy Twyman starts to unfold the world behind the scenes that may be guiding our celebrities like Beyonce or even our president and other world leaders. So please tune in, subscribe today, go over to freemantv.com and just click subscribe. It's very simple, very easy, and I see you all on the other side.
Breaks.